I'm going to put the link in the chat again for the source sheet for anyone who downloaded it already. Welcome to week 7 of 7, Jews and Clothes. Our next series, you got the email, I hope, is going to start January 4th, God willing, Icons of Moroccan Jewry. Everybody from Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi to the Baba Sali, we're going to have some fun in this series. We're going to hopefully learn a lot of Torah as well as a lot of history. Please make sure to register. I also sent out the flyer for Tanakh in a Day. I know some of you have registered. I hope more of you will register, especially those who tell me that they really want to be learning in person. This is an opportunity. You can come for half an hour. You can be there for 6 hours, whatever you like. That's on Sunday, December 25th. So I hope you'll take advantage of the opportunity for that, all free of charge, including a free pizza lunch. Okay, our topic this morning is Tchelet, the return of Tchelet. So this is one more piece of Jewish clothing. It is wool dyed with a dye called Tchelet, and we have a lot to talk about here. I'm going to end up monologuing a lot, probably, because there's so much to discuss in terms of the meaning of Tchelet, what it's about, why it's so important, and in terms of its possible restoration in our day after centuries in which we didn't have it. So, starting point. Tchelet, what is it used for in Judaism? I said I was going to monologue, but I'm asking you. No? Yeah. So, but what is it? What is Tchelet used for?
The talit.
Right, but what color, what coloring what?
It's like a purple, it's like a mauve.
No, but what do we use it for? Yes, Rosalind.
Good.
So one use is for tzitzit, that's correct, those strings on the corners of a four-cornered garment. The other use, which actually shows up further, first in the Torah, is the clothing of the Kohanim. If you take a look at source number 1 on the sheet, I brought you 2 verses there. The first one is from the initial instructions for the clothing of the Kohanim back in the book of Shemot of Exodus. And they shall take the gold and the tchelet and the purple wool and the red wool, which we've talked about, and the linen. We talked about the wool and the linen also in Shatnez. We talked about wearing red. We basically built our class around this verse. So one of the materials that you need to make the clothing that the priests wear, that the Kohanim wear, is tchelet. That's our opening line. And then the second line in source number 1 comes from the Torah portion of Shlach. And this refers to the tzitzit. They shall place on the tzitzit of the corners a tchelet string. So there you have 2 different mitzvot, both of which involve tcheles. What is the symbolism of tcheles? What in the world is this supposed to be about? It is, as was already noted, some kind of a bluish purplish dye. Why does this color matter to us? Is it just God said, I want a color and I, picked this, this one from the spectrum at random? Or is there meaning to this color? Is there significance to the color? Yes, Marilyn.
Well, it's very rare. It's extremely rare. It's not used as much anymore, although our rabbi from Marshall had it on his toys. I think that has something to do with the rarity. It's so rare that it can't.
So a suggestion that maybe it's scarce. So the particular source that is used for this is scarce. However, there are other sources that can be used that are more common. There are plant sources that can be used as opposed to the sea creature. So I don't know if it's scarcity. What would it be? What else could it be? Yes, Ethi.
In Hebrew, tchelet means blue.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming maybe because the blue of the sky and the sea.
Why would I need to use this color of the sky and the sea?
You're saying the meaning, why the meaning?
Yeah, yeah, why would I want that on my clothing?
Because it symbolizes the power of God.
Symbolizes the power of God. So take a look at source number 2. This is a passage from the Babylonian Talmud. This is often quoted. Rabbi Meir used to say, why is tchelet different from any other color? Right? Why is tchelet special? Because tchelet resembles the sea resembles the heavens resemble the divine throne, and he quotes a verse from Exodus at the time when the Jews are standing at Sinai, and beneath his feet, God's feet, so to speak, was a kind of paved work of sapir stone. Sapir may be translated as sapphire. I prefer to just say sapir, actually. And as it were, the very heaven for clarity. That's the line. So we are told that this color is associated with the heavens, and it will remind us of God.
Maybe it's also a sign of royalty.
Maybe it's also a sign of royalty. So we usually associate purple biblically with royalty. Yeah, but he has. But he's also wearing chur. He's also wearing a teretz zahav. He's also wearing tachrich boots v'argaman. So it's hard to say that this is really about royalty. But the approach here seems to be, it reminds us of God. Although you do have to ask a question. When you read source number 2, you realize they did something strange. Tchelet resembles the sea. The sea resembles the heavens. The heavens resemble the divine throne. Why didn't you just say it resembles the divine throne? Why didn't you just say it resembles the heavens, which resemble the divine throne? Why do you need the sea in this mix? So I'll give you one answer, which is that it comes from a sea creature. And therefore, we invoke the sea. That could be one approach. However, Rashi suggests that it's because we're not just saying it reminds us of the sea, which is the heaven. The sea is what God split when he took us out of Egypt. So it's meant to remind us of the miracles that Hashem performed for us in the sea, and then to remind us of God in heaven. That's one possibility. Another possibility, from the, I think he was the second Gera Rebbe, the Sfas Emes, he says, I'll tell you why. It's because the Tchelet doesn't really look like this sapir color of the divine throne. The Tchelet looks a little bit like the sea. The sea, hang on Marilyn, I want you to hear this, looks a little bit like the sea. The sea looks a little bit like the heavens. In other words, A looks a little bit like B. B looks a little bit like C. A doesn't look like C. But A is close enough to B, and B is close enough to C that we're going to willing to say, okay, chain these together, and ultimately it'll remind you of the heavens. So that's another approach to why we mention it. Marilyn, what were you going to say?
Well, I think it's lapis. Isn't it lapis that they use?
So that is a color that gets mentioned. Whether it's accurate or not, who can say? They do talk about that. But I actually think that the answer may well be source number 3. Source number 3 looks a lot like number 2, but it adds an element, and in so doing, I think it adds a really important understanding of what this color is about for us. Take a look at number 3, which is from the Jerusalem Talmud. We talked about the Babylonian, now we switch over to the Jerusalem Talmud, and it's talking about, in context, it's talking about the question of how you can determine that daylight has come, sufficient daylight, to be able to perform certain mitzvot. And it involves being able to tell the difference between different colors, and that brings us to the Tchelet. And look at the line as it shows up here. For the Tchelet resembles the sea. The sea resembles the grass. The grass resembles the heavens. The heavens resemble the divine throne. And the throne resembles the sapir, and he quotes you a different verse from Ezekiel instead of the verse from Exodus. And I saw, and behold, above the rakia, over the head of the cherub, was like a sapir stone, like the appearance of the form of a throne. Ezekiel has a vision of a divine throne up in the heavens. Why they use a different verse is an interesting question in its own right. But what I wanted you to see is that it mentions the grass. You see that? So there's a commentator on the Talmud, Karen Ora, commentary, which explains What you see here in source number 3 is that we are invoking all of the different realms of divine creation. The plant kingdom, right? The sea, the sky. The idea is to say that everything reminds us of God. That's what we're trying to convey here. And that's why we would have the sea, obviously, in it as well. It isn't just about the idea of remembering God, but having all domains remind us of God. Everywhere we look, we will be reminded of God, which is what the tzitzit are about, because the tzitzit are worn on the corners of the garment, and wherever you look, you see a reminder of God. That's the idea. Clear? Okay? So wherever I look, I will remember God. That's what I'm supposed to get from the Tchelet. So, as we're going to discuss in a minute, Tchelet disappears. It appears to disappear in stages, as we're going to see. But somewhere around 1300 years ago, we stop using Tchelet. Between 1,000 and 1,300 years ago, we stop using Tchelet. There was an attempt at the end of the 19th century, or late in the 19th century, to restore Tchelet. If anyone knows Radziner Hasidim, I knew a Radziner Hasid. The Radziner Hasidim were followers of the Radziner Rebbe. So the Radziner Rebbe, Rabbi Gershom Henoch Leiner, thought that he had discovered Tchelet. He thought that he had found the Tchelet and they should start using it. And in fact, Radziner Hasidim, I believe to this day, I knew one who did this, they will have strings on their talit that are dyed with the blue that the Radziner Rebbe said he had discovered. However, it never worked outside of the Radziner Hasidim. Take a look at source number 4, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, writing in Poland at the very end of the 19th century. He says, some years ago, one person claimed he had found the Chilazon. The Chilazon is the sea creature from which Tchelet is drawn. He said he had found it and had made Tchelet out of it, and he attracted a number of people to himself. He thought he had followers who would wear this Tchelet. However, he did not hear approval from the great people of the generation or from the Jewish people as a whole, and the project was nullified until our righteous Mashiach will arrive. He says, it did not work out. He didn't convince people. So, I want to learn the history of what happened to lose Tchelet in the first place. I want to get an understanding of what happened in the Radziner's time. And then I want to talk about a modern attempt to restore Tchelet using a different sea creature, and in all of this, get an understanding of how Judaism approaches that which is new. How do we deal with new discoveries like this? All this and more as part of our conversation for the next 45 minutes. So I'm only going to ask for either questions if something's not clear, or like necessary comments, like on point, this has to be now, because we have a lot to cover in the next 45 minutes, and I want to make sure that we do it properly and clearly, or clearly and properly, better. Okay. So, I also gave you a link in source number 5. That's a link for a class I gave, as you can see, in January 2017, where I discussed Tchelet. That was in a bit of a different setting with people who had a lot of background in text study. And I was able to give more of the text there for anybody who wants to see more. I would recommend downloading that recording to get more than what we're going to cover today. But let's talk first about the disappearance of Tchelet. So we know that in times they're still using it. When I say Talmudic, I don't just mean the Mishnah, I mean the Gemara. As late as the 5th century, beginning of the 6th century, it is still in use. However, Medrash Tanchuma is a volume of Medrash published somewhere between the year 400 and 600 of the Common Era. And look at what it says in number 6. The Medrash Tanchuma on the Torah portion of Shlach, which is where Tzitzit are discussed. It says, the mitzvah is to bring white and tchelet threads and make the tzitzit. When? When there was tchelet. Now, we only have white. For tchelet has been put away. Catch that word. Put away. Put away could mean we don't have it. Put away could mean we intentionally don't have it. We did something to get rid of it. We're going to talk about that. But it appears that sometime between the year 400 and 600, those who are involved in writing down Medrash Tanchuma say we don't have it anymore. Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, a rabbi at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, pointed out that there is a work of Jewish law called the She'iltos, which was written in the beginning of the 8th century, in which they talk about tzitzit and they don't mention tchelet. And he suggests that it's because also it's gone by then. So somewhere around the year 600 to 700 or so, this is disappearing, likely disappearing in stages, as opposed to just suddenly someone snaps their finger and now tchelet is gone. But it seems to be disappearing in stages based on where it shows up and where it does not show up. And the question, of course, is why? I'm going to give you three different approaches to explain what happened to tchelet. The first view is we decided to put it away. It was dangerous to get, for reasons we'll talk about, and therefore the sages said, we don't want people endangering themselves in order to get this, so we're telling people stop using it. If you take a look at source number 7, Rabbi Yeshua of Kutna, writing in 19th century Poland, says, it happened during the days of the later Ravina. There were two sages of Ravina, one earlier, one later, who passed away in the year 4234, 474, by the Common Era count. Because the Tanaim, the sages of the Mishnah, disagreed whether the absence of tchelet disqualifies white, there was a disagreement as to whether tzitzit requires tchelet or are still kosher even if you don't have it. The law had not yet been established that it would invalidate the white, and there was danger in getting tchelet, and he refers you to something in the Talmud about that danger. People endangered themselves to fulfill the mitzvah of tzitzit. He says it was dangerous for people to get it, but people weren't sure whether you had to have it for tzitzit to be kosher. And he says, the rabbis decreed, we don't want you endangering yourselves to get it, therefore we are banning its use. That's one approach, which fits the wording of nignaz in source number 6. It was put away in order to avoid people trying to use it. That's one school of thought. Second school of thought is that it simply became impossible to get it. And I gave you four different reasons for that in source number 8. One, the Romans prohibited wearing certain colors which royalty wore. This goes back to Ruchama's comment about tchelet potentially being royal. So Nachmanides has a comment that the Romans prohibited Jews from wearing certain colors, and that's why this was, if this became difficult to get, it was dangerous to get. Another approach, I've seen it suggested, is that in the year 628, there was a Christian massacre of Jews. And that made it more difficult for Jews to get tchelet. I don't know exactly why that would have made it difficult. I'd have to go back to the writer. It was a fellow by the name of Rabbi Chaim Twersky who made that suggestion. A third possibility, and this was brought by Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog was the first chief rabbi of the state of Israel. And he was also an advanced chemist. He had, I believe, a PhD in chemistry. And that becomes important in a little bit. So Rabbi Herzog is quoted as saying, there was a Muslim conquest in the year 638, and it destroyed the facilities for processing tchelet. So that's another suggestion. And then a last suggestion, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler suggested that it was simply a matter of cost. It became very expensive to procure. And that was the problem. So you have one school of thought that says we stopped using it on purpose because of the dangers and difficulties. Another is that it just became difficult to get, and so we stopped. Alternatively, we didn't know what it was or how to process it. If you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Moses Maimonides writes, "It is not found with us today, for we do not know how to dye it. For not every tichol color in wool is called tichelet, but only a particular tichlut which is not possible to dye today." He says, not every color that looks bluish is tichelet. Therefore, we only make the white. So we don't know which one is right. We don't have information on it in order to be able to use it. Now, when he says we don't know how to dye it, it's actually a little strange, because in his code of law, he actually gives you a process in the laws of tzitzit. Nonetheless, that's what he suggests here, and it's echoed centuries later by Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, saying perhaps it is around today, but we do not recognize it, or we do not know how to trap it. Maybe there's just something we don't know, and that's why we don't use it. So you can already see that by the days of Maimonides in the 12th century, continuing Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra in the 16th century, and continuing into modern times, tzitzit are white. We don't have the tichelet. We're going to see some changes in that, but that's where things were for a very long time. Rose.
My understanding was the problem was the purple color. And the purple color was, I was told, thought an octopus or some kind of sea.
We'll get to which creature it is, but it's not purple.
It's not kosher. It's not a kosher animal.
It's not a kosher creature.
Yeah.
It's not a kosher creature.
So I have a question. How is it that we would do it with a non-kosher creature? I mean, that in its own,
You are correct for asking the question. And in other areas of law, this in fact becomes an issue. So for example, if I'm going to write a Sefer Torah on parchment, do I need to shecht the animal, or can the animal be one that just died, in order to use the hide? We have a concern for using specifically that which is kosher for mitzvot. So you're asking a good question. Maybe I'll include it in the follow-up email later on, because I'm not going to end up getting to it here. But you're asking a good question. I may come back to it in a follow-up email. Okay. Made a note for myself. Hopefully I'll remember. It won't be today, because I have a plane to catch, in a couple hours. Okay. But that's the disappearance of Tchelet. I want to fast forward to the 19th century. Rabbi Gershon Henoch Lehner, or Lehner. Take a look at source number 11, please. He describes what he did to try to find the Tchelet. I, as well, in my poverty, set out and sent to the Mediterranean provinces, and the creature was brought to me. This is literally what he did. He sent scouts to Mediterranean ports, and they brought me a creature. It is one of the species known as fish of dye, D-Y-E, and in German, tint fish. There are about 19 such species, and it appears to me that in one of those species is found all of the signs. Meaning, if I read the Talmud, I find there are certain identifiers for what's called the chilazon, from which this is produced. And he says, I found a species of tint fish that has the signs. If you want to jump down to source number 17, those who are reading it on their screen can see it in color, or if you printed it in color, then you can see a nice picture. The first of the images there is the cuttlefish. This came from the website tchelet.info. They have the pictures that I brought you here. So the cuttlefish is what he's using. Cuttlefish, the Latin name for it, is Sepia officinalis. I'm probably mispronouncing that. My Latin is atrocious. But you know the first word, sepia, right? So that's the name of it, and it is used for dye. And Rabbi Lehner writes three books regarding the identification of the Tchelet and what should be used. And his Hasidim start using it. Some Breslover Hasidim start using it as well. And he argues that even if we're not sure whether this is the right dye or not, we should use it. Because this is a biblical mitzvah. And when you have doubt about fulfilling a biblical mitzvah, the general rule is that you should be strict. And being strict means going out of your way to get this color and to use it. Granted that you can fulfill the mitzvah without it, but he says even if it's the wrong color, it doesn't disqualify your tzitzit. Take a look at source number 12. It's a passage from the Talmud which says, Tchelet does not annul white, white does not annul tchelet, the meaning that even if you're missing the tchelet, the white strings are fine, even if you're missing the white strings, your tchelet is fine, it doesn't matter. Really, you're fulfilling it as long as you have the strings on the corner of your garment. So why not use the tchelet? Well, the answer for why not comes from a few different quarters. One, that Rabbi Yoshua of Kutna, who we mentioned earlier, in source number 13, he was the one who said they put away the tchelet and we don't use it. He says in response to Rabbi Gershon Henoch Leiner, He says, Rabbi Leiner stated that it is a possibility that the tchelet is valid. And since one is possibly capable of fulfilling the mitzvah of tchelet with it, therefore one must do so. Since the tchelet will not harm the wife. He says, if you can do it, why wouldn't you do it? Of course you should do it. He wrote correctly, but since we don't know with certainty that this is tchelet, and many leaders are of the opinion that it has been stored away and we are not obligated in it, we do not abandon the certainty and rule stringently because of the doubt. He says, it's all well and good for you to say, let's be strict, it's a biblical mitzvah, but you're imposing something on the community. He doesn't believe it's a worthwhile stringency. It's a nice possibility. Okay, it's true, it doesn't disqualify your tzitzit even if they're wrong. But he doesn't think it's a worthwhile stringency, right? That people should go spending their money on trying to get this. So he's not a fan. Rabbi Moshe Sternbach, who is a modern writer, you can see in source number 14, he was born in England, moved to Israel, then took a job in South Africa, and is back in Israel. So the Rabbi Sternbach says, no, it's worse if you use this incorrectly. Because there is a law called Bal Tosif. You're not allowed to add to the Torah. If this, in fact, is the wrong color, if this really isn't Tchelet, then people are adding to the Torah by trying to fulfill Tzitzit with this color that is incorrect. So he did not like this. He was not a, he's not a fan of this approach. So go back to Rabbi Leiner's discovery. What was it that Rabbi Leiner thought identified his cuttlefish as the source of tchelet? Take a look at source number 15. These are some of the signs of the source, the chilazon. Passage from the Talmud. The chilazon's body resembles the sea. The body resembles the sea. Well, this cuttlefish is able to camouflage itself with dye, so it looks like the sea bottom. So he says, it resembles the sea, resembles the sea bottom. Its formation resembles the fish, meaning it looks like a fish. Well, you can see the picture, looks like a fish, right? It ascends once in 70 years. Now, the cuttlefish does not show up once in 70 years. Rabbi Leiner argued that what this means is just that there are cycles of abundance and scarcity. There are periods like, think of the cicada, right? The 17-year cycle, or 19, whatever that is. 17-year cycle, I think. So the sometimes it's available everywhere, and sometimes it's not. Cycles of scarcity and abundance, he says. That's what once in 70 years means. And with its blood, they die tchelet. Therefore, its cost is expensive. So this is actually a problem, because what they're using from the cuttlefish is not the blood, but rather a secretion of the cuttlefish. Nonetheless, he's comfortable saying that when it says blood, it doesn't mean literally it's blood. It means the secretion. And the passage in the Talmud concludes, therefore its cost is expensive because it is rare, and they need it to make the tchelet, therefore it's expensive. So Rabbi Liner says, I did it. I found it. It resembles the sea bottom when it's camouflaged. It produces this secretion, which looks blue. I found it. Except, as we said already, not everybody was on the same page. And they had objections on multiple grounds. And I brought you in source number 16. I just made it into a table, as opposed to having 50 sources on the sheet. So if anybody wants really to see the originals, I'm happy to share it with you. If you go to the recording I linked in source number 5 on the source sheet there, I have it there, although that's in Hebrew, the source sheet for that class. But one of the concerns was the signs are incorrect. First of all, the dye color that it produces does not look like the sky, right? Remember we said resembles the sea, resembles the heavens? It doesn't really resemble the sky, the dye you make out of the cuttlefish. Now, I don't know, it depends on where you live, right? Because your sky changes color in different places. But that was one argument. Number two, it's supposed to be color fast. Maimonides writes in his Laws of Tzitzit that the tchelet dye lasts in the fabric. This dye is not color fast. Number three, and this is fascinating. This is Rabbi Herzog. Rabbi Herzog wrote an academic paper, his thesis, I think, actually, on this. It's called Hebrew Porphyry. Porphyry, P-O-R-P-H-Y-R-Y. Porphyry. So Rabbi Herzog, in his thesis, had a sample of Rabbi Liner's tchelet analyzed in two different labs. Okay, this is, you know, going back to, decades ago. And they concluded that the dye, the blue color, was not actually coming from the cuttlefish. What they did was they added certain synthetic ingredients that interact with the organic material, and those ingredients were actually what generated the color. It's from the additives. It wasn't from this chila zone at all. It wasn't from the cuttlefish at all. So that's one set of reasons why they rejected it. They said it's wrong. The identification is wrong. They also objected. Yes, Rosalyn.
Sorry, excuse me. I'm getting lost. Who added these synthetic additives? Who put in these synthetic additives?
So Rabbi Liner didn't do this all himself. He first sent out his scouts to go get sea creatures that are used for a bluish dye. And when he gets the cuttlefish, he works with a chemist to try to help him perfect the formula for this dye. And it appears that the chemist was the one who hit upon this process of adding elements to it in order to get the color you wanted, in order to make it color fast, and so on. And that's where these additives
came
in.
So this is in the 1800s in Poland. They're using synthetic dyes to went to this cuttlefish.
Yep.
Secretion.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Go figure. So one set of objections is that the signs are incorrect. Another set of objections speaks to the issue of new discoveries. Says, why are you stirring up trouble at all? And this is Rabbi Yoshua Kutna, who we saw in number 13. He says, if the white is kosher, who needs the controversy of bringing in something new? Number one. And he says, the Arizal, we learned about the Ari a couple of years ago, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria in the 16th century already said that if we don't have tchelet, there's no obligation for it. So what are you going looking for trouble? And then most fascinatingly, the third issue is a tradition is required. And this is a viewpoint credited to the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, not the one who you're more familiar with, but his great-grandfather. He argued that you need a tradition in order to identify it. Now, there are two different explanations for what he meant by that when he said that. One view, one explanation, I brought you both on the table here. One explanation is that what he was trying to say was, you're telling me the cuttlefish is the right source. People have had cuttlefish for ages. Cuttlefish are not rare. No one was using the cuttlefish to generate Tehillat. The fact that this cuttlefish was always around and nobody used it shows that they opted not to use it. And therefore, you can't use it. You need a tradition. They maybe didn't have a tradition for it, and that's why they didn't use it. That's one version of it. The other version is that always, anytime you're dealing with an identification of an item needed for a mitzvah, you need a tradition to explain what it is, even if they didn't have earlier access. I'll give you a separate example of that. We talked about this many years ago. We had a series on the New World. It was on halachic issues that came up in the Americas. You know when we did it? It wasn't that long ago. It was the very beginning of COVID that we did it. It was like June 2020. We talked about Maybe I'm remembering wrong. But in any case, we talked about the Muscovy duck and the issue of a rabbi who came from Europe to New Orleans and found that Jews were eating a certain bird and considering it a kosher bird, and they didn't have any tradition that this was one of the kosher birds. And there was all discussion, do you need a tradition, do you not need a tradition? So that's similar to this argument here. Now Rabbi Herzog says this is not Tehillat. His argument is not Tehillat at all. He put out his own candidate, something called Jemthina, which if you look in source number 17, it's the shell on the end, the round shell. So he argued that this snail was actually it. You follow? So that didn't catch on either. But he said he thought that that snail, the Jemthina, was actually the right one. So what we've seen, Tehillat disappears, or we made it disappear, one way or the other. Rabbi Leiner thinks that he has found it, and there are three approaches to his discovery. One approach is to say, we're examining it on its merits, and we don't think it passes muster. It doesn't have the right signs. A second approach is to say that we have no obligation to pursue new discoveries. The current system is just fine. Don't start trouble. And then you have the third school of thought that says new discoveries have no standing. You need a tradition to identify it. If I don't have a tradition about what it is, you can't just restart it. Clear? Am I going too fast or we're okay? Okay. So that brings us to the modern age and what's called the Murex Trunculus. If you look at number 17, the middle picture is what we're talking about. This is a snail which produces a clear mucus from a gland. When you expose the mucus to oxygen and sunlight, it changes color to blue. So you have this secretion that is clear, and then it changes color when exposed to air and to sunlight. Chemically, its secretion is very similar to a plant material called plant indigo, which is really, really, really important. The reason it's so important is because the Talmud talks about a substitute for Tehillat that was not acceptable called kla'ilan. It's a plant material. Could be plant indigo. Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, the former head of Yeshiva University, was also a chemist. His degree was in chemistry. He did work in chemistry. And he wrote about this identification. Apparently, the difference between the Murex secretion and plant indigo is just two bromine atoms. That sounds small to me, but I don't actually know what I'm talking about. I'm not a chemist. I was better in biology. I was better in physics. My chemistry year was not great. But that's what he writes about. So the Murex trunculus was actually known as a candidate for Tchelet already decades ago. People had suspected it even as early as the 17th century. There were large facilities for producing dyes that were found along Israel's coast at the end of the 19th century, and there were Murex shells there. So Rabbi Herzog considered it, but he rejected it. He rejected it because, number one, the creature does not look like the sea. Number two, it isn't available every 70 years. Number three, he thought that the dye was not color fast. It wouldn't remain in the fabric. And number four, the color you get from it is more purplish than blue. That was his argument. Nonetheless, in the 1950s, we start to see movement towards this. Yigal Yadin, right? The famous Yigal Yadin finds ancient fabrics in the Bar Kokhba caves, right, near the Dead Sea, that are dyed with plant indigo, or believed to be plant indigo. And the color looks the same as that color produced from the Murex. And again, the dyes are very similar chemically. They also found Iranian fabrics in Siberia. Somebody was traveling. They were fabrics from the 4th century before the Common Era. And they were dyed with Murex, showing that Murex was in use as a dye at that time, and the dye was indeed color fast. They also discovered Murex shells by the thousands in those dye production facilities in the Mediterranean. They also discovered a coin from Bar Kokhba's time with a Murex shell on it. In the early 1980s, researchers discovered that if you leave this out in the sunlight, which was done with ancient dyeing techniques, it in fact turns blue. And in 1985, they found a flask from 1300 before the Common Era in Lebanon, with particles of dye identical with the Murex dye. So here is the evidence in favor of the Murex. First, I bring you source number 18 from Pliny in the 1st century Common Era. Pliny writes, so you're talking about somebody who is in Rome. He says, purples live mostly 7 years. Like the Murex, he's talking about purple as a creature. Like the Murex, they keep themselves in concealment for 30 days, about the time of the rising of the dog star. In the spring season, they unite in large bodies, and by rubbing against each other, produce a viscous spittle from which a kind of wax is formed. The Murex does the same, but the purple has that exquisite juice which is so greatly sought after for the purpose of dyeing cloth, situated in the middle of the throat. This secretion consists of a tiny drop contained in a white vein from which the precious liquid used for dyeing is distilled, being of the tint of a rose, somewhat inclining to black. The rest of the body is entirely destitute of this juice. It is a great point to take the fish alive, for when it dies, it spits out this juice. From the larger ones, it is extracted after taking off the shell, but the small fish are crushed alive together with the shells upon which they eject this secretion. He's talking about drawing a dye. He's talking about a procedure which is very similar to the process found in the Talmud. Now, that does not prove that it's treles. Let's be very clear. It just proves they are drawing a dye in a similar process from these creatures. But what we have in terms of evidence, and I bullet pointed it in source number 19, is you found ancient dye production operations with the Murex shells. You have the Murex on the ancient coins of the Bar Kokhba revolt, not all of the coins, but on some. You have a dye that looks like plant indigo. The dye becomes blue with exposure to sunlight. I'm just looking at what I wrote on the sheet. It's not quite matching what I put in my notes. I'm going to go with what I wrote on the sheet. when the sages warned against use of the plant indigo because they said, hey, this isn't Tchelet, but it looks like it, they didn't warn about the murex, even though they knew about the murex, right? If they felt murex was not right, they would have warned, don't use the murex. We have no other creature that we know of that produces such a color. It becomes blue with exposure to sunlight, it's color fast, it has a shell, which is a passage in the Talmud that indicates the Schila's own creature has a shell. It was named in certain responsa from recent centuries as a candidate. And it's found along the Mediterranean coast in areas that match the portion of Zivulun, which we are taught in the Talmud is the portion where the Chila zone shows up. Are you convinced? I'm seeing some people saying yes, some people saying not necessarily. Yes, Sarah.
I'm not concerned. I'm questioning the fact that they have crushed the shell. That means they don't kill the animal in a decent way.
So the animal dies. Let's not kid ourselves. The animal dies as part of the dye production, this snail. But we also, you know, shecht animals. I mean, that's a reality.
Yeah, but we shecht them without them being in pain.
Mm. So you're saying...
Crushing seems to be very violent and very...
So I have to say that that's not going to disqualify this. I hear what you're saying, but it's not going to disqualify this. We can lump it together with Rose's question about this creature being non-kosher and how am I using it for a mitzvah. As you know, legitimate questions, but not ones that will disqualify the murex. Epi.
Well, if a creature isn't kosher to eat, then why doesn't mean we can't use it for other things.
No, but we do have such a tradition for certain things. We say, if this is from a non-kosher creature, then it's not valid for certain mitzvot. Like, there is such a concept. So,
okay.
Rav Herschel Schachter is of the view that one should wear it. He says, one should go with this. It may not be right. However, it's not massively, massively expensive if you can afford to do it. And even if it's the wrong color, it doesn't disqualify the tzitzit. So he is good with that idea. You just say, I'm wearing this just in case. This is the correct one. Rav Usher Weiss says, absolutely not. Rav Usher Weiss is a leading rabbi in Israel today. And he argues no. There are others who argue no, but he is sort of the leader in this regard. And his objections mirror the objections that we saw to Rabbi Leiner with some development to it. First of all, he says, and you see the table in source number 20, he argues the proof that you're bringing, the signs that you're bringing, are not necessarily valid. First of all, he says, he takes the view that Tchelet was put away, right? Like we talked about, it was put away. And therefore it can't be that we're going to have it now. He points to Rabbi Epstein, who we saw in the beginning in source number 4, who said, the project was nullified until our righteous Mashiach will arrive. When the Messiah comes, we'll have it. We're not going to have it until then. Not everybody agrees with this perspective, but that's one point. He also says it doesn't have everything that we're talking about. We said it's supposed to look like the sea, right? We saw that in the Talmud. It's supposed to look like the sea. This doesn't look like the sea. You can see, for those of you who printed it out in color or are looking at it on your screen, yeah, this kind of conch-style shell doesn't look like the sea. It's kind of brown. So there's a Rabbi Baruch Sturman, who is a leader in this pursuit, who has written a lot on the topic, and he says, not so different from what Rabbi Leiner said, it blends in with the sea bed, because it's covered with small organisms, just like the rocks and shells on the seabed are. So he says the shell blends in with the seabed. To which others respond and say, that's all well and good, but that's not what we're talking about. We want the body of the snail inside the shell to resemble the seabed. But that's one argument, is it doesn't match the color of the sea. Number two, the secretion is transparent. The secretion that you're talking about is not black, as it is supposed to be in order to be valid. It's a transparent secretion. Number three, I'm looking at something in my notes. I want to make sure that I said that correctly. I believe I said that incorrectly. Let me restate that. The other way around. The objection is that let me skip that one because I don't want to say it wrong. The business about being black, I don't want to say it incorrectly, and I don't have a chance right now to look it up. So let me skip that particular objection. He argues as well that it doesn't look like a fish, and according to the Talmud, this should be a fish. He says it doesn't look like a fish. There are others who suggest it's okay, it's like a worm, fine. He says it doesn't show up every 70 years. So he objects to those facts of it, and there are those who have responses to all the things that are objected to. He also doesn't like the process. He says because the dye is coming from the secretion instead of being from the blood, and the Talmud says the blood. He doesn't like it because he says, the Talmud says it's better to take the dye while it's still alive, and here you are crushing it. He says the original process detailed in Maimonides for getting the dye, he says nothing about exposing it to the sunlight. So he argues not all your signs are really there. There are responses to each of these points. For example, the argument that it's not from the blood, yes, but you could say it's a secretion that emerges beside the blood. It doesn't have to be the blood per se. They go back and forth with this. But that's argument number one. Argument number two is to say, just like was said to Rabbi Leiner originally, you're trying to wedge the murex into all of these signs, and it's not the blood, but it's the secretion, which is like the blood, and it doesn't look like the sea, but it looks like the seabed. He said, why are you trying to force this? You can fulfill the mitzvah without it. Why are you forcing this? That's a second argument. Third, Rabbi Weiss seems to suggest that we don't have a Mesorah. We don't have a tradition, just like was argued with Rabbi Leiner. But the most fascinating argument that he brings, as far as I am concerned, is his fourth argument. He says, discoveries that qualify in scientific argument don't necessarily meet the test of halachic proof. Meaning, when you're dealing with archaeology, and not just archaeology, but archaeology is the case at hand, you have a set of data, and then you try to come up with a theory that explains the data. Right? You do the best you can. And if someone comes along with a piece of data that contradicts your theory, then you throw out the theory, you modify the theory, and you come up with a new theory. But theories are not proof. And Jewish law works with proof. You need something tangible as evidence. It's not enough that you can say this matches the following, criteria. That doesn't work. For every point that you discover that you say supports your theory, I can come up with another theory that will also match it. So, for example, you say that Pliny, in his manuscript, talks about taking dye from the purples and the murex. Who is to say that what he called a murex is what you call a murex in our day? He uses the term murex. We use the term murex. Does that mean it's the same creature? Not to mention, he says, there could be manuscript errors in what you've recorded from Pliny. He says, you discovered that there are dye processing operations along the Mediterranean that have murex shells. Okay, but who says that those were for generating Tehillah? That just means that they used Murex to generate a dye. That doesn't mean they were using it to generate Tehillah, per se. That's his argument. And he says, if you'll tell me, well, if these facilities are not the right ones, then where are the real ones? My answer will be that they were destroyed because the Romans decreed against us using it. You say that because the Tehillah matches what we call indigo, that's like the original Tehillah, which matched Kla Ilan, their plant that could dupe people, that was a substitute. But who is to say that our plant indigo is their Kla Ilan? You see how he does it? He goes through each data point and he says, for each point that you bring, I could come up with an alternative theory to explain it. So he argues you can't use your theories in order to prove what Tehillah is. And he goes on and on. There's a lot. He has I forget how many responses. I think four responses, Rabbi Weiss, on this topic, arguing against it. For all of these reasons, he says it doesn't match the signs. There's no duty to make it try to fit. You need a tradition, and bottom line, it's theory, and it's a nice theory, but it's theory at the end of the day. So he is against the resurrection of Tehillah in our day. I hope this was somewhat clear. That's the argument. Someone sent me a message in the chat asking, if we say that the Jews wandered in the desert for 40 years and that's a theory, where is the proof? So there's a difference, because we're talking here not about a question of history. We're talking about a question of, should I be using this item for my fulfillment of the mitzvah? If I'm a believer in Judaism and so on, should I be using this item or not? That's where I'm going to need proof. In terms of Judaism on the whole, that's something that I take on faith. And, you know, yes, there are arguments. Can you prove it? Can you prove it? They found, you know, this type of archaeology has discovered such and such. We can do that all day long. But faith in the researchers who identified the Murex as Tehillah is different from faith in God that what I'm told in the Torah is true. Okay, thank you very, very much, everyone. Yes, Etty.
I need some clarification. Is the thing that you have to use trellet for the tzitzit, and it comes from the chilazon, is it actually in the Bible?
So go back to source number one, right? That's where you find the statement that you have to use trellet. They shall place on the tzitzit of the corners a trellet string. The identification of where Tehillah comes from is a tradition that's not spelled out, because the Torah just assumes you know what Tehillah is. You know, it's in the same way that the Torah doesn't define various things. It just assumes that you know what they are. It doesn't give you a description. It just expects you to know. So, yeah, the same thing is true regarding this.
So when they say the chilazon,
that's a Talmudic term.
Okay. But because in Hebrew, chilazon means snail, not fish.
Yeah, true.
So I'm going with the guy that's saying it's coming from the snail.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, everyone. I'm sorry I can't stay longer, but I do have a plane
have
to catch.
Have a safe trip.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Be well.
Thank you. Bye.